nuclear physicist Dr. Annie Kreitcher of the National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory designed the experiment that broke headlines in December of 2022. For the first time, a fusion reaction was achieved that created more energy than the energy that went into the reaction. Welcome to Infinite Wonder. I'm Renee Kerrigan, bringing you conversations with the people who make amazing science happen. On December 5th, 2022, an experiment ran at the National Ignition Facility at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. 192 lasers were used to deliver 2.5 megajoules of energy into a pea-sized gold cylinder containing a peppercorn-sized pellet of hydrogen isotopes, deuterium and uranium. The laser's pulse of energy caused the capsule to collapse, reaching temperatures only seen in the cores of stars. The hydrogen isotopes fused into helium, releasing additional energy and creating a cascade of fusion reactions. The reaction released 3.15 megajoules of energy, about 54% more than went into the reaction. Achieving fusion on Earth has been a dream for over 50 years. This successful experiment puts humanity a giant leap forward in the progress towards a clean, carbon-free energy source. Today on Infinite Wonder, I speak with Dr. Annie Kreitcher, who designed the successful fusion experiment. Dr. Annie Kreitcher is the design lead within the inertial confinement fusion team as part of the National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. In December of 2022, her team succeeded in achieving fusion ignition. For the first time, a fusion reaction was achieved that created more energy than went into the reaction. Dr. Kreitcher, thank you so much for being my guest on Infinite Wonder today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this fusion reaction that was such a big splash in the news, it's such a huge accomplishment. You were the design lead for this experiment that for the first time, you were able to have a fusion reaction that produced more energy than went into creating that reaction. So can you please describe that experiment, what you designed to achieve this fusion energy gain?
Sure. So what we're doing here in these experiments is we're essentially creating a miniature sun in the laboratory, and that's to reach the extreme conditions that are required for getting a significant amount of fusion energy out of a system. So we have to get...
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say we have to get to the conditions, very, very high temperatures, very high pressures in these experiments so that the fusion itself can take over and result in quite a bit more yield out than what we put into the target. And so my role in this was to choose the conditions, the input conditions to the experiment so that we can reach the conditions that are required to jumpstart this process or the ignition process. So for example, we have our target and we shine a giant 192 giant laser beams onto the inside of a can. And inside of the can sits a BB size capsule that contains the fusion fuel. And my job as a designer is to use a variety of tools to set the target dimensions, materials, the laser conditions, the compositions of the target, the laser conditions. So we don't just slam the target with all the laser energy at once. We define very specific laser power at very specific times throughout an entire time history of the laser being turned on. And so I set those conditions to try to get to these extreme conditions, to get to the sunlight condition in our plasma so that fusion can take over and then we can get ignition.
Wow. So I have more follow-up questions about that, about the conditions that have to be just so to achieve this reaction. But before I dive into some of those more detailed questions, let's talk about fusion for just a little bit for our listeners who maybe are a little less familiar with the concept that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And you said something incredible, which is that you're creating a tiny sun-like condition in your experiment. Mm. And so what this means, of course, is that fusion is when two hydrogens fuse into a helium. And that's what you're creating in your experiment as well.
Yes, that's correct. So in fusion, we smash two hydrogen isotopes of hydrogen. So hydrogen with one extra neutron and a hydrogen with two neutrons attached to it. So it's called deuterium and tritium. We smash those together and we make a really high energy neutron and a helium.
And this is only achievable on a large scale in the cores of stars.
That's correct. So the challenge here, the main issue with fusion is it requires extreme temperatures for this nuclear reaction to happen. So this is because we have two hydrogens, essentially, which are both positively charged. And to get them to fuse together, we have to overcome the electrostatic repulsion to get them close enough that the strong nuclear force takes over. And that requires 100 million degrees temperature or more.
And so far in our scientific journey with fusion here on planet Earth, not in the core of stars, people are perhaps more familiar when they think of nuclear fuel. They're thinking of fission, mm-hmm. of breaking apart of the atoms to create these extreme temperatures that can produce energy. But fusion is combining these elements. And the when the elements combine, that can produce that energy without the use of carbon.
Yeah, so fission is what we use currently in our nuclear reactors. And that's when you take a really heavy nucleus, so lots of protons and neutrons, that's a little bit unstable. You feed it a neutron. So it doesn't have to get to extreme conditions, but you feed it a neutron and then it fizzes. It separates into two pieces with extra neutrons. And that's how we get the energy from fission. Fission has the potential issues that it can create long-lived nuclear radioactive waste. And also there's eventually going to be a limited supply of this fuel, fission fuel. And fusion is nice because it doesn't have either of those two issues because the products that we're creating are helium and a neutron. And in addition, unlike others, current sources of energy that we have now, fossil fuels, it doesn't release carbon in those reactions to create energy.
So this is why everyone was so excited about this big announcement back in December that for the first time, an experiment was successful at producing more energy from a fusion reaction than the energy that was basically used to hit the material that created that reaction. And so can you help us understand, you talked a little bit about like the very nuanced design that had to be created to create this reaction. And I was reading about all the iterations that you went through as you were trying to mm-hmm. refine your experiment. And it seemed that the symmetry of the capsule that you hit the laser beams with was really important. So can you describe that a little bit? What was so important about getting that shape just right?
Sure. So basically the main difference between this gain equals 1.5 experiment where we got 1.5 times the amount of energy out as we hit the target with, the difference between that and the prior experiment, which was a little bit more than two to three times lower yield, was to fix the symmetry of the implosion. And what that is, I'll describe that a little bit more simply, is we're trying to compress something the size of a basketball down to the size of a pea. That's sort of what we're trying to do to create these little suns. And we have to do it spherically, and we have to do it to the 1% level. And if we don't do that, we can't efficiently couple the driver energy to our plasma that's creating the fusion. And so adjustments were made to the radiation drive or the radiation oven, the way that we drive this to create a symmetric implosion. It wasn't, the capsule wasn't more symmetric. It was the drive outside of the capsule that we used to drive the implosion. So when we hit the laser, when we hit the target with the laser beams, that creates a 3 million degree X-ray oven.
Wow.
And the capsule that sits inside of this oven, the outside of that capsule explodes. And so just like a rocket, when you have the rocket fuel exploding off of the back end and it pushes the rocket forward, that actually pushes the fuel inward and you get very high convergence and you basically can squeeze the fusion fuel to the conditions you want. But if you can't do that in a spherical way, you get things shooting off to one side or the other, or kind of squashing out in one direction. You can't efficiently converge all that material down and get it to the starlight conditions.
That's amazing. So what you're doing is you have to be very careful to create the perfect conditions to create the perfect shaped explosion, implosion to ignite this reaction. That just, and tell me, how quickly does all of this happen?
The actual experiment?
Yes.
The design process?
Both, actually.
Okay, sure. So an actual experiment, the laser is turned on for 9 nanoseconds. So 9 billionths of a second.
Goodness.
And then the energy release from the fusion is about, it's trillionths of a second, 90 trillionths of a second. And a nice way to think about that is the amount of time it takes light to travel 1 inch. And so this all happens very quickly in the laboratory. The design iterations to get to this point, it's sort of been a continuous learning process for many years. So I've been in the program more than 10 years in this specific area of the program. And my work on understanding symmetry actually started 10 years ago. And so we've, along the way, we sort of, we continuously improve our design aspects. And we also gain understanding that can help us use the tools we have, which aren't perfect, together with our observations to build an understanding over time on how these things can behave. And the development of the tool that I used to control the symmetry here, that has been in the works for several years now also. The design iteration specifically now with all that understanding from the last experiment to this experiment happened rather quickly in the order of a couple of months.
So years and years of knowledge building. But after that success you had a couple of months ago, then several months design for just to create this next successful experiment. That's amazing. And you started to mention the team, and I'm always curious about the teams of people it takes to make these big discoveries happen, because we all know that no one makes a scientific breakthrough really completely independently. It takes large teams of people. Can you describe how many people worked on this fusion reaction experiment and what types of backgrounds they come from?
Sure. So you're right. We have thousands of people that have contributed in the past or are helping now, many people that are helping now to actually pull an experiment off. We have a variety of different teams with different backgrounds. So we have the team that works on the laser and upgrading the laser capability, which is something that I used in this experiment, was the upgraded laser capability. We have a target fabrication team that's working on trying to make our targets more pristine. So these targets have to be pristine on the order of defects the size of bacteria. And so there's a massive R&D effort on developing these very pristine targets that we shoot. We have a whole team working on setting up experimental diagnostics so that when things go well or when they don't go well, we sort of know what happens and we can diagnose the plasma that we created. We have a design team. And so we sort of learn from each other. So as a principal designer, I can work with designers that that are working on other areas, and we can learn from each other. And then we have a lead experimentalist. My co-campaign lead, Alex Zylstra, is responsible for making sure the experiments actually go as planned. And we as a team and many others on the team, theorists, et cetera, discuss these changes that are made before the experiments to have the peer review and the idea building.
Are most of the people on these teams you've described, are they physicists? Are they engineers? Do they come from different backgrounds in education, or is there sort of a similar background there?
Great question. So, you know, all the way from entry level to PhD, we have engineers, we have physicists, people supporting the facility operations, the physicists running the plasma physics simulations and looking at the plasma diagnostics. So, within the physics area, we also have a diverse background. We have mechanical engineers, chemical engineers. And so it's a complete spectrum of both level of degree as well as area of expertise in degree.
I imagine that with the laboratory that you have, with these 192 laser beams, that you also have to have very skilled workers who are working on the mechanics and the actual physical structure.
Yes, that's correct. Very important. Without that, we wouldn't be able to shoot the laser.
So speaking of the laser, I was describing to one of my science education coworkers, you know, that I would be speaking with you today, and he was asking me a very basic question, like how the laser actually works. And, you know, you describe the lasers as 192 lasers, and the facility is described as being the size of 3 football fields. So I'm curious, if these lasers, they're enormous and they're putting off an enormous amount of energy. Is it a scaled up version of, you know, the devices we might use to in a classroom as a pointer or to play with our cats? Like, is the basics the same, or is it something different altogether?
No, that's a great question. The way that a laser works, it's the same basic concept. You have optical amplification, and you have stimulated emission of light at a specific frequency. But the types of lasers we're using here are different. They emit a different wavelength, and the size of the buildings here contribute to the fact that we have a lot more energy in these laser beams. And so, so in the type of laser that we're using and the size of laser that we're using and the duration that it can be, the duration of time that the laser can be fielded over. So we actually want the shorter billionths of a second duration. That's also different. It's not a continuous. So the basics are the same. And you mentioned something about how do we get all that energy into the target, or did I?
Well, I was curious about that because I noticed, you know, as you mentioned before, it's just a couple nanoseconds pulse. And so the lasers are physically very big, but the pulse of energy is very short. And then the target is also tiny. And I thought there must be something to do with that ratio that's really important.
Yeah. So the laser beam line is very large. We compress that down in time, and we also focus that down in space to get these very short, about 9 billionths of a second duration for the laser pulse, and to get it into a target that's the size of 1 centimeter. So when the lasers come in, they have a very small spot size. So we're taking all that energy and then focusing it down in space and time to get the intensities that we need on target to then reach these high energy density conditions.
So with this big breakthrough that happened in December, what is the next hurdle that the laboratory, the teams at the laboratory, and that you and your team are working for? What's the next horizon you're trying to reach?
That's a great question. So in these experiments, although they were successful, we burned up about 4% of the fusion fuel. So there's quite a bit left that we can burn. And the degree to which you can burn this fuel up depends on your plasma parameters again. So we're trying to get ignition, but we're also trying to get to the right conditions to burn up the extra fuel. And that typically, that usually takes more driver energy to do that, because you want to put more emphasis on keeping the implosion together, but you also have to ignite it in the first place. So it's essentially a race against time, because we have these implosions. We're trying to get to the right conditions so that the fusion itself is self-sustaining for long enough that we can burn up as much of the fuel as we can before it explodes back out. And there's a variety of cooling mechanisms that we're competing with. And so the idea is, can we get to the right conditions where both fusion takes over and we can hold it together long enough before it explodes back out, so we burn up more of the fuel. And so we have ideas for how to do this in the future. We can kind of keep pushing in the same direction that we just did. So we improved the symmetry in the last experiment, but this was also part of a new effort to try to hold it together longer and burn up more fuel, which we did. So the idea is to keep pushing in that direction. And we can do that with, we're looking at a few different things. One is trying to improve the laser even more, get a little bit more juice out of the laser. And we're also exploring more efficient ways to convert the laser energy to an X-ray oven so mm-hmm. that we can get a little bit back there. So trying to drive these implosions that stay together longer is an energy cost. And so we're trying to get that back somehow.
That's it, as you described that, I remember reading that it was a pea-sized amount of fuel. Is that correct?
It's about the size of a peppercorn.
Okay.
But when you visualizing compressing a basketball down to the size of a pea is good, because you can think about it in a relative sense. You have to squeeze a whole basketball down to the size of a pea. But now we're actually starting from a BB and squeezing that down to the size of half of a human hair. So wow. We're starting from a BB size capsule or a peppercorn size capsule, and then we're squeezing that down to half of a human hair width.
And in that successful reaction, you said still just a portion of it, 4%, was actually consumed?
It was burned up.
So it would be the next goal is to be able to sustain that. Part of your next goal is to be able to sustain that reaction longer, so that more of that tiny infinitesimal seeming amount of fuel can be burned up.
That's correct. And you know, if we can burn more fuel, that's a huge win. You can burn more fuel by increasing the time that you're hot. You can also make the burn hotter. And so the reaction, the DT reactions depend on both time, the number that you can get close enough to each other, and the temperature. So we're looking at all three ways to try to get a little bit more burn up.
Well, it's very exciting, and I hope it was gratifying to you and all the folks who work there at the laboratory who are involved in this experiment. You know how excited the people were, just the public was to the announcement, because it was definitely something that was all over the news. My dad sent me a text the next day and said, "Warp drive has been achieved." And I said, "Wait, do you mean the fusion reaction?" He said, "Yes, it's the next thing, warp drive." So, yeah. That's a segue to my question of that you probably get asked a lot. But why is this work important? Why is fusion important? How do you see it benefiting humanity as we continue to work on this project?
Great question. So I think, you know, it is, first of all, is extremely rewarding, not just to see the impact it's and the hope it's giving to the general public, but also to people in our field that have been working for many, many years on this and maybe haven't had a win in a while. And so it kind of gives us that win. It invigorates people. More people are starting to apply to universities that want to work on fusion. So that's actually more gratifying than getting something to work technically, is the impact that it has on other people. And in terms of the long-term impact and why I care is this is the holy grail of clean, limitless energy. And there, it's not going to happen overnight. It's probably not going to happen in the next decade. But if we don't start somewhere and start making progress, then it will never happen. And the fact that these recent results crossed a barrier, it sort of gives hope that there's a there. And I think that will impact basically everybody, because there will come a point when we can't continue on the track that we're continuing on for energy. And so the thought that it can impact not only the general public, everybody, that it can impact future generations, that our kids and our kids' kids. I mean, I have 3 children, and you know, I want to see them live a nice, comfortable, happy life, as we all do. So I think there couldn't be a more gratifying thing to work on, and it's a very grand challenge, and that's exciting. It also has, you know, it's also great security for the nation. So there's many aspects of working on this project that have been very fulfilling for me.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And it's related to another question I like to ask anyone who works in science, or almost any field that I speak with, which is what do you love about the work you do? So you talked about sort of the bird's eye view of what you hope for it, but maybe there's something a little bit more with the day to day. What is something about your work that you really enjoy doing?
That's also a great question. I actually really like running the computer simulations and digging into them. So I simulate what these little hair-sized plasmas look like, and then I try to square that with what we actually observe and try to understand if there's gaps. So to me, it's sort of and then you try to figure out how to improve upon those gaps. And it's like a giant puzzle. So I just really love puzzles, and this is a puzzle that combines the physics that I enjoy looking at and the type of simulations I like to run on a daily basis, and basic theory. And so it's a cross section of a giant puzzle of really interesting physics that even on a daily basis, we're continuously trying to understand. We never fully understand everything. We're continuously trying to understand and learn, and also at the same time make progress. So coming up with solutions, being able to test your solutions, will the symmetry actually impact the implosion in a way that we expect, and then doing the experiment. So for me, that's the most fun part of my day. I do also love working in a team where we're all pulling together to make something happen, and we can all share in the success of something happening and bouncing ideas off of each other. So this being in a team environment like this and working on these puzzles is really, it's really fun.
It sounds fun, rewarding, and challenging. So another question I like to ask is, did you know you wanted to be in this role when you were young? Did you know you wanted to go into physics? I'm just curious about the path you took to get to where you are today.
Yeah. So when I was young, I guess I didn't really know what I wanted to do. It wasn't till really the end of high school that I realized how much I love math and that I was good at it. So I didn't, you know, like when you're kind of going through and you're not sure, what are you even good at? And then things sort of just seemed to make sense. And I liked the quantitative nature of math, that it wasn't subjective. It just was, it was what it was. And so then I was also really interested in engineering. And from Northern Michigan, and you know, there's lots of engineering, great engineering schools there, and a lot of engineering influence. I like to see how things work and build things is another thing that really excites me. So then I went to the University of Michigan, and they had this program, this nuclear engineering program. And I'm thinking, like, what's that? Well, it's a cross section of engineering and really complicated math and theory. So I thought, okay, well, that looks fun. So I did that at the University of Michigan. And then when I was finished, I wasn't quite ready to be done. I wanted to do more. So then I went to graduate school out here at Berkeley, and it being so close to the lab, built my connection with the laboratory as well as a summer internship. So I came out to the laboratory as a nuclear physicist and then saw NIF, and I was like, okay, that's what I'm working on. Like, it just wasn't a question. There's a few things in life where you don't have to think too hard about it and you just know. And I guess for me, that's when I knew I want to work on this and make an impact. And so that was kind of, and then I did my thesis work at Berkeley, working out here and kind of getting understanding of the plasma physics, and then moved into the designer role about 11-ish years ago, after being a postdoc in experimental physics. So that was the path I took.
Clearly a good fit for you and the laboratory, I think, to find you in that place. It's really, I can imagine seeing the facility and being so excited and inspired, just knowing that that's what you had to put your energy into. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So another question I like to ask anyone who's accomplished great things, which a lot of folks have in a lot of different areas. So no one has accomplished great things without overcoming like significant challenge. So can you tell us mm-hmm. about a time that you've had a significant challenge in your career and what you did to overcome that?
Yes, this is very, very much the case that it's success is built off of failures, and not usually one failure, but many failures. But the point is you try to figure out what is this failure teaching you and how can you make it better in the future. So back when this hybrid E campaign first started in 2018, the beginning of it, maybe 17. And then we did our first DT experiments in 2019, and they came in way lower than predicted. And one of the issues was that we had to figure out how to make, we had issues with the targets. But another big issue was there was one area of design space that was being maybe not quite fully optimized. So it's hard when something seems to just not work, and you have one big shot and it doesn't work. And it's hard to at first to get up and go back to your office and figure out what happened. But luckily that quickly wears off, and that's part of like the team support thing. And we're all trying to pull together to figure out what happened. So then, looking at all of the evidence, and then coupling that with our understanding from the simulations and trying to figure out what is the thing that's not being fully optimized. And then eventually moving to basically, we started out a little bit too big. So we're trying to make the implosion bigger without more laser energy, and did a bunch of things to try to optimize and do that. But we ended up just basically half the size of a human hair too big.
Wow.
And then reducing the initial size of the capsule that contains the fusion fuel by half the width of a human hair enabled me to re-optimize some of the design parameters. So then it worked experimentally. And that was kind of a big turning point for the hybrid E campaign. So it's a series of, first you sort of feel responsible and you feel bad about it going wrong, but then you have to quickly get back into the game and use that to try to make it better for the future.
And those are moments when your job being a big puzzle probably feels, in the moment, a little bit less enjoyable when it's not going quite right. But then when you overcome it, so rewarding.
That's correct. Yeah.
Last question for today is just that, what advice would you give to someone who's interested in getting involved in a career in science? What do you recommend to people who are inspired or interested in pursuing this in their future?
So I will point out, if you're inspired or interested, but you think maybe that's not the typical career path for you, ignore it and just do what you want to do. I say try things. I didn't start out working on fusion in the beginning, and when I was at Michigan, I did radiological sciences and health physics, radiation health physics, and then moved over. Sometimes you'll think, well, if I haven't been doing this since, you know, if I haven't known I wanted to do this since day one, is it too late? It's never too late. Do follow your heart and do what you want to do technically, because that's how you're going to overcome big hurdles and have the perseverance to keep going, as if you're working on something that you really love to work on. And if you look around and you say, well, there's not many people that look like me in this field and maybe I won't fit in, that's not true. I think a diverse set of backgrounds and even personality types, a diverse set of people is key in having all the perspectives. And so you'll bring something really important to the table.
Absolutely. It takes big teams of people from all over the world to make big discoveries and big breakthroughs happen. And your laboratory is a great example of that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Annie Kreitzer, thank you so much for being my guest today. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. I hope you can find some wonder in your world today.